for argument, United States v. Adkins. Mr. Anderson.
May it please the Court, I'm Howard Anderson. I represent Mr. Adkins in two consolidated appeals. One involves a guilty plea for a child pornography charge, and the other comes to you from a jury trial. I'd like to briefly address the guilty plea issue first and then move on to the more substantive issues in the drug charge. In Appeal 12-3739, the only issue before you is whether the district court plainly erred in imposing special condition number 5, which says that Mr. Adkins may not view, listen to any form of pornography, sexually stimulating material, or sexually oriented material, or patronize locations where such material is available. As I have laid out in the brief, I think that is plainly erroneous as violating a basic due process. And what I would ask is I would just challenge the government to explain to you whether they think that prohibition extends to literary works like Romeo and Juliet, which is a play about underage minors having sex, or whether it extends to 50 Shades of Grey, whether it extends to supermarket magazines like Cosmopolitan magazine, which has all
sorts. Is this a First Amendment argument or a due process argument?
It's a vagueness argument, Your Honor.
In which domain?
The statute is vague and overbroad because it doesn't say what the district court actually wanted Mr. Adkins to avoid seeing. And because it implicates his First Amendment rights, it's especially important that it would be clear as to what is and is not prohibited.
And what about the appeal waiver issue? And this might be a good claim, but for that appeal waiver.
There are two exceptions to this court's jurisprudence about the appeal waiver. One is if it falls outside the scope, and then two, if it violates.
Falls outside the scope? What are you talking about?
Of the appellate waiver. Did the parties contractually agree that this particular claim falls outside the scope of Mr.
How does it fall outside it?
The appellate waiver talks about that I'm giving up my right to appeal the sentence and restitution. And as I've laid out there, the courts sort of take different views as to whether a special condition of a supervised release qualifies as part of the sentence or not. And so here I would say that I think that if there's any vagueness in the term, I should construe it.
I don't understand you. Why doesn't the appeal waiver encompass this?
Because I don't think that a challenge to whether the district court was clear as to what it meant falls within a challenge to his sentence.
I understand that this sexually oriented stuff is vague, but what is it in the appeal waiver that excludes this supervised release term?
Again, Judge, we're not challenging the district court's ability to prohibit Mr. Adkins from.
I want to answer my question. What is it in the appeal waiver which excludes your objection to this term of supervised release?
I don't think that it falls other than the meaning of the term sentence. I think that when the government wrote the term sentence.
Supervised release is part of the sentence?
The appellate waiver says sentence and restitution, and if you have to give all the words in the contract meaning, I think ordinarily we think the restitution.
You're saying supervised release is not part of the sentence?
As the government drafted as the government.
Well, I don't know. If it says sentence and restitution, why doesn't the sentence include the supervised release?
There are cases that I've cited where courts of appeals have considered the issue and said that a sentence does not encompass terms of supervised release. And so, again, I would say that since the government drafted the contract.
I don't understand. What is supervised release if it isn't part of the sentence?
It's the. In the contract, you have to give all the terms meaning. And
parole was a sentence when we had parole, part of the sentence.
I think that when the parties talked about sentence, they meant how much time is he going to spend in prison.
Why didn't you say that?
Because I think that that's what most people think about when you think
that's
of.
That's ridiculous. What do they think supervised release is? If it's not part of the sentence, what is it?
I think that if the parties...
What is it if it's not part of the sentence? What is supervised release?
I think it's supervised release, Judge.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
But even if you find that it falls within the scope of the waiver, there's still the constitutional exception. And here I think the district court just is not clear as to what it does and does not want to prohibit. And so I think that, that you should remand for the district court to clarify what it is exactly that Mr. Atkins cannot read and cannot watch. So that's all that we're asking for in 3739.
Well, Mr. Anderson, you just mean categories, right? You don't want specific works. Is that what you want, a listing of specific works?
I think the judge has to define what is sexually oriented material. What does that mean? So it just has to be
what
more precise.
What does it mean to you?
Well, Judge, as I've cited, there's a wide variation in America's understanding of what sex even means.
Well, I don't think that's
quite right. Suggesting there's no capacity then within a term of supervised release to issue anything similar to what the judge did here?
No, Judge. In United States v. Jacques, there's a similar term, and the parties remanded for the term to mean how Congress had defined it in one of the child pornography statutes, I think. So that's all we're asking for is just a more precise definition, and you can borrow one from a statute like in Jacques, but as it's written now, I just think it is vague and ambiguous. And because we're talking about his First Amendment rights to read things or even go in libraries.
Just say that he shouldn't be allowed to watch child pornography, or is that what it should say?
I don't know what the judge below meant, but I think that there is a more precise term that the judge could use if what he wanted to say is you can't watch movies that appeal to the prurient interest or something like that. So you can say non-obscene materials, he can't possess obscene materials with child pornography. But as in Jacques, there are ways that you can craft the term, but here I think the district judge was just, because no one had objected, he was just a little bit sloppy, I think. Onto the appeal from the trial in 12-738, there Mr. Atkins was charged with attempted possession of heroin with intent to distribute it on or about January 29, 2009. And the big issue at trial, I think, is that the government introduced evidence that about a week before the date of the controlled delivery, Mr. Atkins supposedly went up to Canada with the intent to possess heroin, with the intent to distribute it to Mr. Jordan. And so the issue that Mr. Atkins raised below was under 404B. That evidence shouldn't have come in at all.
Why is this a 404B question? Isn't that trip just part of the same drug transaction? He planned, the scheme was for him to go to Canada to pick up the heroin, and he couldn't get in, so the supplier shipped it in the snowman.
As I've laid out, one of the other issues is that him going to, if the jury believed that he went to Canada with the intent to possess and distribute the drugs, that's a separate crime in and of itself. And the jury instructions here actually permitted the jury to convict him for either one. So the problem is if it's actually part of the crime on January the 29th, then the jury instructions permitted the jury to say, even if we have reasonable doubt as to what happened on the 29th, because we find on the 21st that he attempted to possess heroin with intent to distribute it, we can convict him for that. So we don't actually know which crime he was convicted of at trial. And, in fact, the government argued below in their closing arguments that the jury could infer or could find the substantial step on January the 21st. And so the problem here is that if this conduct had been 6 months before, it wouldn't have been a problem for the substantive argument here. But because it's so close in time, the government does not dispute that the jury instructions actually allowed the jury to convict for either one.
Okay, that's a separate question from the 404B. So you've kind of moved on onto that. So is that a concession that there's not a 404B problem here because it's all part of the same transaction?
Judge, I certainly disagree with you there. The reason that the district court I said that it came in is because Mr. Atkins intended to possess drugs with intent to distribute them on the 21st.
That was the secondary rationale. The first rationale was that this isn't 404B evidence at all. This isn't other acts evidence. What it is all part of the same transaction. There was one delivery method that failed, and so the second delivery method, the snowman,
right,
succeeded.
Right.
So
I don't think that it's actually part of the crime that's charged, because for the crime that the grand jury charged, the substantial act had to occur on January the 29th. And so that would be when he went to the door and answered it, or he held the package. That was a substantial act. So I don't think that the trip to Canada actually qualifies as the actus reus for this charge. And judges, I see that I'm already into my rebuttal time, so if I can, I'll just sit down and
okay. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Holler?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Dealing first with the second issue that Mr. Anderson raised.
I share his concern with the sexual orientation provision in the supervised release. What does that mean?
What does pornography sexually oriented or sexually explicit mean? Or, I'm sorry, sexually stimulating mean?
Yeah.
Most courts have interpreted that in light of 18 U.S.C. 2256.
Tell me what you think it means.
I think it means any material that is designed to sexually stimulate the defendant.
Oh, how about Romeo and Juliet? As Mr. Anderson mentioned, it's underage sex. Juliet is only 13.
Well, I think, I don't know that Romeo and Juliet would necessarily be included unless it was a, you know, visual staging and involving
nudity
and sexual.
Well, of course, it is a play,
Romeo and Juliet. If the purpose of the play was designed primarily to sexually stimulate the observer, of course.
Oh, come on, that's ridiculous. This is completely, This you're worried about child pornography. Why do you care about other pornography?
Well, I think the plain error context is important here, Your Honor. When these provisions have been...
Come on, you explain to me. If a person, you don't want him to be involved with child pornography, that's obviously appropriate. What does adult pornography have to do with that?
Well, there is lots
do
of evidence, Your Honor.
People watch adult pornography become child turn into pedophiles?
I think there is evidence in the literature, Your Honor, that establishes that many of these defendants who have child pornography also have vast quantities of adult pornography of very young adults who are nearly children.
Young adults? That's not child pornography.
It is not child pornography, Your Honor, but the point is when the defendant is on supervised release.
Come on. I don't understand that. Why does the government care about, if you don't care about adult pornography in general, why do you care when someone who likes child pornography, now he knows he's not allowed to have child pornography, at least he has adult pornography. Well,
I think that the literature does not support that, Your Honor. I think the literature supports in general, and this isn't in this case because it wasn't challenged below, but I do believe that in general, I mean, it's just like saying, well, somebody who doesn't drink alcohol should still be allowed to stay in a bar because they want to. There's a sliding scale, and as individuals need to stay, many of these individuals need to stay far away from pornography.
You don't cite any literature on this.
Well, it was not raised below, Your Honor, and indeed, even the Ninth Circuit has suggested that these provisions are appropriate.
Sex doesn't make you a prospective pedophile. That's a very small percentage of the population of pedophiles.
Your Honor, if this were raised in an appropriate case where there was not an appeal waiver and where we were not on plain error review,
I don't think an appeal waiver relates to provisions which are incurably vague. Because then the defendant has no idea how is he supposed to figure out whether something is sexually oriented?
Well, again, Your Honor, we believe that defendants can figure out what is sexually oriented material. Just as in the child pornography context, we can distinguish between naked images of children that are not pornographic and images that are designed to sexually stimulate individuals.
But again, we get back to Romeo and Juliet.
So if the image is designed to...
Hey, don't interrupt me.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is he allowed to watch a a staging of Romeo and Juliet.
A normal, ordinary staging, yes.
That's my question.
Yes,
yes,
he is allowed to
no.
watch Romeo and Juliet unless
Why?
The purpose...
Romeo and Juliet shows sexual activity... sexual activity or intended sexual activity. No, I think it's actual sex. Between an adult, Romeo, young adult, and a 13-year-old.
Unless the staging involved actual sexual acts between two actors, I do not
now,
believe...
Wait a second. So you think this provision of supervised release only relates to literature or art or movies or what have you that actually depict a sexual act?
If it's designed to be
sexually oriented means?
Well, that's what the Ninth Circuit said when it said sexually explicit material was could be banned, even if it was an adult nature.
But this provision in this case is not limited to sexually explicit.
It's limited to sexually stimulating or sexually oriented
pornography. What does sexually oriented mean? Now, a great deal of literature and art is sexually oriented in the sense that it depicts or reminds people of sexual activity.
The courts have interpreted that in light of 18 U.S.C. 2256, as we pointed out in our briefs, to be materials like those that are pornographic. To be materials like those.
They're not pornographic, but they're like pornographic. They're quasi-pornographic.
They're quasi-pornographic, yes, Your Honor.
Oh, come on. You can't tell this guy that he can't watch anything that's quasi-pornographic. He doesn't know the word quasi. And what does it mean, quasi-pornographic?
It's generally interpreted in light of the other items that are found around it, meaning pornography. And the courts have essentially all held...
items that are around it. There is pornography. But what is quasi-pornography?
I believe that quasi-pornography would be material... It's designed to be closer to the line. It's designed to suggest that material that might not be considered to be obscene or prurient...
This is not something the government should be doing.
If the defendant had objected to it below, we could have reviewed it.
This is silly. You should never have suggested that. You should never have suggested this provision to the court. It's hopelessly vague.
Your Honor, if in future cases these materials are clarified, the court can always deal with that in 18 years when the provision could first be enforced. At this point, though, Your Honor, the appeal waiver clearly covers this. This is
you
part of the sentence.
Have an appeal. You cannot have an appeal waiver that produces nonsensical results. You can't have an appeal waiver which says that if he violates the terms of supervised release, we'll cut off his left ear, right?
I don't, in light of the fact that many
now,
other...
suppose that were the provision. Would the waiver be effective when they come to cut off his left ear?
When the waiver covers terms of...
Answer my question,
no,
yes or no. Why
no,
would
not.
It not be?
It would not because no court anywhere has upheld such a provision, whereas countless courts have upheld these provisions. And under those circumstances...
That's a very bad argument.
Well, Your Honor, that's the argument that we're making to the court this day. We believe it is waived, and we believe it is not
plain error. Like this in supervised release.
In light of the comments that this court has made, Your Honor, I will relay that back to our office, and we will review these in future cases.
You. I appreciate it.
And I'm happy to do that.
Thank
but
you.
Under the law in this particular case, we believe that should be dealt with in a future case. And if in a future case the court comes to that conclusion, then in the future we would look at this in 18 years and revise the provision accordingly.
Mr. Howler,
we're happy to do that.
Mr. Howler, just before we leave it, why couldn't we have just ended with any pornography? The subset where the or comes in is where the troubling vagueness couldn't pornography alone have covered what you're also attempting to cover in sexually stimulating or sexually oriented?
It might, Your Honor. As Judge Posner points out, I don't disagree with that with much of what he says. The courts have grappled with this and have come up essentially in different circuits with different terms that are going to be included. Now, I think all the courts disagree with Judge Posner that you just can't do this at all. You can't prohibit when someone's on supervised release. You can't prohibit them from possession of adult pornography at all. But they have come up with different terms. The Third Circuit and the Ninth Circuit have said you can't use the term pornography, but you can use the term sexually explicit material. The Fifth and the Eighth Circuits have said you should use the term sexually stimulating or sexually oriented. Now, you know, maybe this needs to go to the Supreme Court for them to resolve exactly what term should be used. But I think as long as, on plain error review, I think as long as it's generally understood at this point what that term is being meant right now, then if in the future we need to go back under the provisions that allow modification of supervised release and use exactly whatever term this court or another court actually decides that's what is intended, or if in the future courts disagree and strike that provision down, of course we will deal with it then.
What kind of restrictions do prisons and halfway houses and pre-release centers use on this kind of material? I assume that there are some. They've been litigated or maybe not.
I mean, there has been litigations in some contexts about whether you can prohibit prisons from receiving Playboy or magazines of that nature. And generally, if there's a purpose for it, if there's a prison-related purpose for it, you're not eliminating all magazines, you can do so.
Right, but they must have a definition of pornography or sexually explicit material that they exclude from prisoners.
I suspect that they do, Your Honor, and I think they usually use either the term pornography or sexually explicit material. But again, none of that is in the record in this case because this wasn't challenged
right.
below.
Right.
And so I think it's better to wait for a case where this can all be teed up, where the government can produce literature in a more, you know, organized fashion than in a case on plain error review where we had seven other issues to contend with.
Right.
That's
and
our only point.
Supervised release is just another form of control, a lesser form of control than a pre-release center or halfway house or a prison being the maximum form of control.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That would be the proper domain to analyze this in.
I think that's true as well, Your Honor. I am running low on time. The other issue that the defendant raised was the Canada trip evidence, Your Honor. And in this particular case, the evidence that was undisputed was that the package was mailed from Toronto to Louisville, intercepted, delivered, and the defendant received the package, said, "We've got goodies," and ripped open the snowman. The evidence in this case was evidence, first of all, the evidence of the bus ticket, the Western Union receipt, the passport that showed that 8 days earlier he had made a trip to Canada couldn't even remotely be construed as bad act 404B evidence. It's merely evidence that's designed to show that the defendant is connected to Toronto, that the defendant's confession that he knew that this material was coming from Sam, because Samuel John is the person whose name is on the Western Union receipt, that he's connected to this material, that he didn't innocently rip this open. He knew it contained heroin. He knew what it contained. And so by the same token, again, we believe, Your Honor, that the evidence of his own statement that the purpose of that trip that you have all the evidence of was to get the same heroin that I couldn't get, so they then shipped it via UPS, is again direct evidence of the crime.
Well, moving from the evidentiary issue to the instructional issue and how the jury was instructed, was it the case that the instructions and the argument that was made to the jury that this trip could be the overt act that proved the attempt as opposed to the circumstances of receipt of the snowman?
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. We cited to the pages in our brief where it was even clarified of the government's witness. He's not being charged with that January 21st trip. He's being charged with the January 29th trip. And indeed, we led off our rebuttal argument, which is on page 3 of our appendix. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Let's not confuse the main issues here. The main issues are twofold. One, did Nathaniel Jordan and Scott Adkins knowingly attempt to possess the heroin on January 29th, 2009, with the intent to distribute it? And the second issue relates to the firearms charge. So I don't think, on a plain error standard at a minimum, there is no reasonable probability that the jury, even if it could through some sort of mental gymnastics, have come up with that conclusion. I don't think there's any reasonable probability that the jury ever would have done such a thing. This was argued to the jury. It was explained to the jury what the indictment charged. It charged the offense on January 29th. All of the evidence, other than this brief part, or this brief statement of his, related to that. And by the same token, even if it could therefore thought to be error, it's pretty clearly harmless. The only evidence of the January 21st trip's purpose being to get heroin was from the statement that they so vigorously attacked. The evidence of the January 29th trip was the statement that they so vigorously attacked and all of the other surrounding and supporting material, Jordan's daughter's testimony, the evidence of the heroin being shipped, the fact that when he got the cute little stuffed animal in the mail, he didn't give it to a kid, he ripped it open because he knew there was drugs inside of it. So for all those reasons, I don't think that there can be any real argument that this was error, let alone...
I ask you about it. It didn't come up in oral argument. His offense in England, is it clear that foreign crimes are not part of criminal history?
Foreign crimes are never part of criminal history, Your Honor. Yes.
But the judge can consider them under 3553A.
Yes, they can.
Did you want the judge to give any weight to that offense? It was another drug offense.
We did ask the judge to give weight to that offense, Your Honor, and the judge, I think, did give weight to that offense by giving the 12-month consecutive sentence. That was one of the reasons that he cited, was that his criminal history overall was underrepresented. There is a note in the guideline about that. I believe we cited the guideline itself in the brief, but I can tell Your Honor that the guidelines do say that foreign convictions are never counted at all because with hundreds of other foreign countries, we don't necessarily know what process they were given in each case. But, you know, if it's a British conviction or a Canadian conviction or a country that we generally think gives good process, you can consider it. But it is, as often, the guidelines are a one-size-fits-all kind of solution, and you have to adjust accordingly otherwise.
Sir Holler, do you want to spend a moment on the issue of the amount of heroin and the failure of the jury to make a finding on that?
I can, Your Honor. I think it's adequately covered in our brief, at least to the extent of, I mean, this court dealt with these issues in Apprendi, and I think the same sort of issue applies in Aline. As far as the statutory maximum goes, the maximum of the supervised release did not change, and the maximum, this court has always said on the maximum issue that because it's below the 20 years that would that should have been applied, it doesn't make any difference.
I'm talking about the jury didn't find the amount, right?
The jury did not find the amount, right, but that's how the
and
court applied in Apprendi.
This is an interesting case where we've lost the drugs, right?
Well, we did lose the drugs, Your Honor, and so if the jury had wanted to say, well, we don't believe that there were drugs, they could have acquitted. But it seems to me very, again, under the standard that this court supports.
Well, I'm not talking about so much acquittal versus conviction as the ability of the judge to make a determination on amount in the factual setting here, that's all.
Understood, Your Honor, and the court should not have made the finding under Aline. That's clear. But what this court said in Nance, in the mandatory minimum, in the statutory maximum context, this court said Nance applies in Kirkland. This court said Nance applies in the Aline context as well, which essentially means if any reasonable jury that convicted would have found the drug quantity was over 100 grams, then the error is harmless when it was not objected to below, as it was not here. It was arguably waived below. So under those circumstances, as I said, the jury could have said, no, we just don't believe the government. But once the jury says, no, we do believe the government, we do believe there are drugs here, there's no reason to believe that the government wasn't telling the truth about the weight. And in fact, there's another factor in this case, which is the defendant even said in his statement, when I got this thing, it didn't feel like there was 300 grams in there. Like I was worried that maybe they found the drugs. Mm-hmm. So that's another indication that in fact there were 299 grams, in fact, of heroin in there. So I think under those circumstances,
it just gives me a little pause in a case where we have this issue of vouching.
I don't know how.
Is this an experienced prosecutor?
She's been a member of the office for 6 years, Your Honor. It would have been 3.5 years at the time of this trial. It was an inadvertent statement, Your Honor, under the circumstances.
No, I appreciate that. I'm not questioning the ruling by the district court. I'm just suggesting, you know, as you go back and reflect on the cases and the issues.
I understand, Your Honor.
Judge Posner, in connection with in a case where we have the absence of the physical absence of drugs, the issue of vouching gets a little closer to the line. That's all I'm suggesting.
Understood, Your Honor. Understood. If there are no further questions, I'm well over my time, and I would ask that the court affirm on all counts and dismiss on the child pornography appeal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. So, I'm sorry, Mr. Howell. I'm sorry. Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to follow up on one point about the appellate waiver issue, I've cited Seventh Circuit a case law that says that a vague statute is poses a jurisdictional problem. So I would say that the same should hold true for vague sentencing conditions, that the district court actually has no jurisdiction to enter a vague, a hopelessly vague sentencing condition, and so that should fall outside of any contractual waiver for that. As for the merits, again, going back to the issue of drugs, one of the issues is, did Mr. Atkins have the intent to distribute the drugs? And the district court said, because he intended to distribute them on the 21st, he must have intended to distribute them on the 29th. And I think that, for the judge...
And what other interpretation could there be of his conduct?
Well, that falls into the propensity argument that because he intended to do it before, he must have...
I understand. What is the alternative theory of what happened on the 29th?
I think that if Mr. Atkins had contested... if Mr. Atkins had said, pretrial judge, I'm going to deny that I had any knowledge of what was coming in the package, I think the evidence could have come in. But here, we're ruling pretrial before Mr. Atkins has even contested anything. The judge says, I'm going to let it all in. And so I think that the problem is because the judge ruled before he even knew what Mr. Atkins' theory of defense was going to be. And you know, perhaps Mr. Foley could have explained it better in the pretrial argument, but as it stands, the judge made the ruling before he even knew which issues the defense was going to contest.
Well, what was the theory of defense?
After it came in, it was one of sloppy investigation because the government lost the drugs. They didn't bring the camera. There were mistakes in the report because it was either cocaine or heroin. They destroyed the drugs, and so it was more of a sloppy investigation was what happened after the evidence came in. But had the judge said, I'm not going to let it in, or at least I'm going to wait to see what you say in opening statements, Mr. Atkins could have based his defense on maybe I intended to possess it, but I never intended to distribute it to anybody. And so that would have been a perfectly valid defense to the indictment charge because the indictment said that he had to possess with intent to distribute.
Was this weight personal quantity?
Would
that have even been a remotely plausible defense that any
The trip to Canada was supposedly for Mr. Atkins to deliver the drugs to Mr. Jordan. I don't think there's any evidence that he intended to sell those drugs to the general public. And here on the 29th, Mr. Jordan already has the drugs, so it's not like Mr. Atkins can distribute them to Mr. Jordan. So all the drug stuff was found in Mr. Jordan's bedroom. He had the scales. Mr. Jordan was the one who was going to get all the proceeds from the sale. So I think it would have been a valid theory of defense to say the only reason I was going to Canada was to give them to Mr. Jordan, but I didn't need to distribute them on the 29th because Mr. Jordan already had them. And so all I was trying to do was just give them to Mr. Jordan. And so I think that would have been a valid defense at trial, Your Honor.
And that's not a distribution?
Yeah, you have to distribute them to someone else. And if Mr. Jordan already had them because he actually signed for the package, Mr. Atkins couldn't distribute the drugs to Mr. Jordan because he already had possession of them. Okay. And as for the jury finding issue as to the amount of the drugs, the government says that Mr. Atkins waived the right to have a jury find it. But again, I don't think it's a defense lawyer's job to ask a trial judge to instruct for a more serious charge, the one that the judge wants to, or the one the government asked for. I think the proper time to object is at sentencing, when the government has decided which charge it wants to proceed under, and that's the time to object. And so there at the sentencing hearing, Mr. Atkins said, hey, I've never had these drugs, so I dispute the quantity of the drugs. And so I think that was enough.
I understand what you said about Atkins not distributing the drugs to Jordan. Where do you think Jordan got the drugs?
When, Your Honor?
What do you mean, when?
I don't understand your question. I'm sorry.
Where do you think Jordan got the drugs?
He signed for them.
What?
He signed for the package on January the 29th.
Who supplied him with those drugs?
That would be Sam up in Toronto. So, but the issue is, on the 29th, did Mr. Atkins intend to distribute them to anyone? And I don't think he can intend to distribute to Mr. Jordan because Mr. Jordan already had them. He signed for the package.
You're making a bystander argument, basically. He just happened to be there.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ripping open the head of the snowman.
So he could have intended to possess it, but he couldn't intend to distribute it to Mr. Jordan because Mr. Jordan already had them.
That, of course, makes what happened in Canada on the 21st very relevant, doesn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
You don't think that connects Jordan to Atkins?
Well, they were living in the same home, so I think they were already connected. So Mr. Atkins lived in the basement.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Anderson. So you were appointed, were you not? Well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. We thank Mr. Holler as well.